Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Shannon Spaulding, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Oklahoma State University. Her new book, How We Understand Others, Philosophy and Social Cognition, is just out from Routledge. Social cognition includes the ways we explain, predict, interpret, and influence our interactions with other people. The dominant philosophical theories of social cognition, the theory theory and the simulation theory, have provided focused accounts of mind reading, the practice of ascribing beliefs, desires, and intentions to others in order to predict and explain their behavior. In her new book, Spaulding draws on social psychological, developmental, and experimental psychological research and kindred spirits in philosophy to argue for an expansion of this traditional focus. In her theory, which she calls model theory, mind reading includes other methods we use to understand others, such as stereotypes and scripts, and other goals of these practices, besides prediction and explanation, such as strengthening our in-group social relationships. She also explores some of the implications of her view for understanding issues in epistemology and ethics, in particular, the issue of epistemic injustice. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Shannon Spaulding. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Your new book, How We Understand Others, Philosophy and Social Cognition, kind of gives a nice, very nice overview of the state of play in terms of the mind reading literature, and also puts it forward, I think, a bit in terms of incorporating a lot of the new insights in recent years into a particular new version, I guess, of the theory as you describe it. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the details of the book, maybe you can say a bit about your background in philosophy and then how you came to write this book.
Yeah, sure. So I started out interested in social cognition when I was a master's student at the University of Arkansas, but that was just nothing that I had the space to explore. So I read Sean Nichols and Stephen Stitch's book, Mind Reading, just sort of on my own, and found it really, really interesting. But I had to wait until I got to my dissertation stage at the University of Wisconsin to actually explore it in more detail, which was many, many years later. So I've been thinking about these issues for a while, and my dissertation was on this topic. In 2015, I believe, I was on a research fellowship at the University of Edinburgh, and I was having lots of conversations with Swelyn Lavelle, who also works on social cognition and philosophy, about this sort of strange disconnect in philosophy from social psychology. So philosophers and psychologists, in particular developmental psychologists, and even some sort of psychologists who study chimpanzees and such. They work really well together, and their literatures kind of overlap, and they reference philosophers and psychologists. But left out of this picture nearly completely is social psychology. And part of that is just that they have a really different terminology and really different methods, and there's some sort of some concern about the replicability of some of the research. But there just seem to be, even beyond that, this kind of like not talking about or talking with social psychologists at all. And so Sui Lin and I were talking about this and sort of thinking through ways that you could get the social psychology and incorporate it without this already very robust interdisciplinary research. And so the idea for the book came in that fellowship in 2015, sort of talking through some of these ideas with people who thought about it as well.
Okay. So maybe we should begin where you begin, which is, in a way, a kind of brief review of where philosophy has been in terms of mind reading. It's, as you mentioned, the mind reading literature in philosophy for a long time, for a number of decades, kind of rolled along on its own, not really affected, you know, too much by what was happening in social psychology. So what is that mind reading literature? Maybe just to give a brief description of what philosophy was doing over the past couple decades, you know, the whole idea of folk psychology and what sorts of, you know, specific things were meant by mind reading and what specific things were the goals of mind reading?
Sure. So the literature starts in earnest with the animal psychology literature. So back, way back in the 70s, I suppose, there is this concern that all of the experiments that were trying to test whether chimpanzees specifically have the ability to understand other chimpanzees' mind, whether they understand and attribute mental states like beliefs, for example. All of this literature was infected with the problem that you couldn't tell whether it just looked like they were attributing mental states, and there was some behavioral explanation that actually was not mentalistic that was available. And so what happened was that Daniel Dennett was involved in this research, and he came up with the idea of the false belief task. And the false belief task is this really ingenious task that tries to localize whether or not somebody really, or somebody or some animal has the concept of belief. And the basic idea is that if you can attribute a false belief to somebody, that is, if you infer that somebody perceives the world in a way that it really isn't, then that is a sufficient bar for attributing to you the concept of belief. Because if you can understand that somebody has a false belief, then you understand that there's a way in which the world really is, and there's a way in which this person or this animal conceives of the world. And that's really different than that those can come apart. So if you can grasp that someone can have a false belief, then this is sufficient for attributing to you conceptual knowledge of belief. So Daniel Dennett comes up with this just purely conceptual idea of an experiment. And Joseph Perner and Ted Ruffman, who are experimental psychologists, find out about this idea, and they actually experimentally test it. And it turned out to be a really useful experiment. And the false belief task has basically just been the founding experiment of this literature on mind reading. So mind reading, just for those who don't already know, is the ability to attribute mental states to other people in order to understand their behavior and anticipate what they're going to do next, or various other things along those lines, which I'm being sort of cagey here because I want to actually expand the conception of mind reading, but we'll get to that in a little bit. So the false belief task is the sort of the starting point of the mind reading literature. And a lot of the mind reading literature in philosophy and experimental psychology was built around this. And it's not that anybody thought that all there really is to mind reading and to understanding others' behavior is attributing beliefs or attributing false beliefs. But it came to have an outsized role in the mind reading literature because it just seemed like, well, if you can do this very difficult task, then, you know, you've made it pretty far in your journey in learning folk psychology. And the rest of the stuff will just fall in place. After you get this very key piece of folk psychology, the rest of it will just be there for you. So the two main theories that kind of grew out of this literature were called the theory and the simulation theory. And both of them share this commitment to explaining how it is that we attribute mental states, particularly belief, though there is some literature on desire as well, how we attribute these mental states to other people. So just in brief, the theory basically is the idea that how we infer mental states, which are in a sense unobservable entities, is a little bit like scientists infer unobservable entities. We have a lot of information and we make an inference to the best explanation about what mental state is causing this behavior, and that allows us to make some predictions about what somebody will do next. So I see, just to take a sort of silly example, one of my students comes in late to class and she looks towards the front of the classroom, and it just so happens that on that day there's a guest speaker in front of the classroom. So my student hurriedly enters the classroom, looks towards the front of the classroom, and then turns around and walks right out. This is a mind reading task. What is she thinking? Why did she do that? So on the theory, the basic idea is that you take in a bunch of information that you know about your student, about the class, about how people's behavior interacts with their mental states, how mental states interact with other mental states, and you make an inference about what it is that she believes or what it is that she desires. And then you make a prediction on the basis of that. On the simulation theory, the kind of main contrasting theory, you don't have to rely on all this information, this kind of rich body of theoretical information about other people's psychology. You just, in a sense, kind of put yourself in that person's shoes and simulate what you would be thinking and feeling in that situation, and then just project that to or attribute that to the other person. So you can get the same results, you can get the same belief attributions with either the theory or the simulation theory. In this case, it's plausible that both theoretical inference and simulation would get you to the verdict that the student thought she walked into the wrong classroom, and then she's going to go outside and check the classroom number and then come back inside when she realizes that I'm still there and all of her classmates are there. She'll come back and sit down in the classroom. But this is the basic idea. So the theory and the simulation theory share this commitment to explaining how it is that we attribute mental states, especially belief, but they have a difference in the process that they think leads to this belief attribution. Those are the kind of the two main theories that dominated the literature for several decades. And then it kind of sputtered out a little bit, and people stopped offering this kind of monolithic theory and the monolithic simulation theory, and started articulating more hybrid versions of these few that saw a role for both theoretical inference and simulational inferences as well.
Yeah, that was my understanding. It kind of devolved into a little bit of both, and also a difficulty in kind of distinguishing them, because the more that each one got refined, the more they seemed to move together.
Yeah. It was just a sort of dividing up the pies. Like, okay, you take this category, I take that category. And then I think it lost a lot of steam when that started to happen.
Yeah.
So since then, I mean, things have gotten a bit revived, I think. It sort of became this internecine quarrel. But people coming from somewhat different backgrounds, like Sean Gallagher, the phenomenological tradition, and then Kristen Andrews from the animal cognition tradition, these people started criticizing that debate or the various theories of mind reading from very different perspectives. Could you say something about, you know, how they kind of opened up the debate and kind of rejuvenated it in a way?
Yeah, they did. So in really, really different ways, actually. So Sean Gallagher and Daniel Hutto and various other figures in the 4E movement. So there's embodied cognition, extended cognition, and active cognition, and who knows what the fourth one is. there's so many of them. They call the 4Es. But I primarily focus on embodied cognition. They have slightly different versions of their critiques of a kind of mainstream cognitive science. But embodied cognition, the challenge to mind reading stems from a more central challenge to cognitivism in general. So embodied cognition is just really skeptical of the idea that the best way to understand the mind is in terms of these internal mental representations and the computations over these representations. So it's a really fundamental disagreement with a lot of psychology and with a lot of philosophy. The embodied social cognition version of this is just an application of that. So it thinks that, so Sean Gallagher, for example, thinks that we don't need to resort to attributing beliefs to other people. We can get by with what he calls body reading. So we don't need to attribute mental states. We don't need to attribute beliefs or desires. We can just see in somebody's body language what it is that they're doing and anticipate what they're going to do next on the basis of really minimally mentalistic things. So it's like norms and behavioral scripts, things like that. So we don't have to attribute beliefs to other people. Mm-hmm. Or desires or intentions and things like that. And so there's this kind of movement to look at this, look at social cognition from top to bottom really differently. So in terms of the sort of psychological stuff, in terms of the neural mechanisms, right, they're looking for ways to excise mental states. Some of them, some embodied cognition theorists are more radical about this. And so they think that you just don't need mental content at all. You don't need intentionality at all. So Daniel Hutto and Eric Mayan fall into this camp. They are just really skeptical of the idea of mental content and intentionality. Others are less, they don't go down that road, so they're less radical. They just think we can explain a lot of social cognition without resorting to these sort of conceptual devices. We don't use mind reading all the time, though, of course, we are capable of it. So that's the kind of embodied cognition challenge. The challenge coming from people like Kristen Andrews and Victoria McGeer and Tad Zawidzki, who offer a more pluralistic view of folk psychology, is really different. So there's no skepticism about cognitivism implicit in their views. I think they accept the cognitivist viewpoint just as much as the mainstream philosophers and psychologists do. But what they're pushing is the idea that mind reading is just a really minor tool, I should say, of in our toolkit for understanding other people. Along with mind reading, we also have what Tad Zawidzki calls mind shaping. It's not that we're trying to read others' minds. We're trying to shape others' minds to be more predictable and to be more along the lines that are kind of established in our culture. So when I tell somebody, like when I tell my daughter, for example, but you liked pizza. You know, she's currently like on a pizza boycott. I'm not reading her mind. I'm trying to get her to make her mind more in line with what I think it should be. I think I'm reminding her, trying to get her to be rational, to sort of like, oh, that's right. You have said that you liked pizza in the past and you want to conform your behavior and conform your mindset to this way of being. The problem is that she's two and irrational. So that didn't work. But there's this idea that there's just a lot more to understanding other people than attributing beliefs. So Kristen Andrews writes about the role of stereotypes in our understanding other people. Victoria McGeer writes about regulative folk psychology. This is a lot like mind shaping, where what we're trying to do is kind of, with the use of norms that dominate our social interactions, we're trying to regulate our interactions and regulate other people, and importantly, regulate ourselves, right? So when we tell ourselves that, you know, this is, you know, I want to go for a run, part of what I'm doing is making it the case that I want to go for a run. There's something important about saying this out loud or writing it down or telling somebody else. And when I tell a student, you know, you're just having a hard time, I'm trying to get them to adopt that attitude too. So it's not all about trying to figure out what somebody's mental states are. It's also about what shaping what they are. So their challenge is really different from the embodied cognition challenge. In a sense, they want to add more tools to the toolkit. And I'm much more sympathetic to this view. My own perspective is that the pluralistic folk psychology view endorsed by these theorists is more or less on target. The criticism I have is that you can't actually separate mind reading from these other tools. What I go to lengths in the book to argue is that attributing beliefs and mind reading in the narrow sense, attributing beliefs and desires and intentions, is just inextricably linked with the stereotypes that we have, with the norms that we are abiding by, with our desire to shape other people, with our desire to manipulate a situation, with our desire to confirm our own worldview or, you know, boost our own self-esteem. Like, these are all intertwined in really messy, messy ways. So it's a mistake to think that you can say something about mind reading that's separate from the way that you treat these other things.
Okay, so this idea that it's all intertwined in a messy way, as you just mentioned, are there any ways to clarify that? I mean, how do you think that might be theoretically illuminated in some way?
Yeah, so I mean, it's complicated, but the way that I try to do this in the book is to separate out the factors that serve as an input to mind reading, like the things that you pay attention to, and the factors that influence the mind reading process and the factors that influence the mind reading output. So this is not the only way that you can think of this. It's just particularly helpful for me to think of it this way. So something like the situational context that you find yourself in is hugely important in figuring out what kind of mental state somebody's going to attribute to another person. So we are all really familiar with the killings of unarmed Black men. Comparing that to the situations where you have, say, an armed white man who is belligerent but somehow comes out of the situation unscathed and arrested without being harmed or killed, no less. So I talk about this in various papers and in the book, and part of what's going on here, though by no means all, is that the situational context that you find that you, anybody, or police officers in this particular example find themselves in is just really influential in how you interpret what you're seeing. So if you see this interaction, on an urban street corner at night and a place that's sort of notoriously dangerous, you're going to see this interaction through a certain lens. If you see this interaction Sunday morning, we're like on the corner of a church in a predominantly white neighborhood, you'll see this very same interaction, just really differently. Mm-hmm. And you don't, that's not the sort of thing that you have easy reflective access to. It just shapes the way that you see things. It shapes what you pay attention to. It shapes the kind of the scripts that you're employing. So when you're looking at an interaction, you pretty immediately kind of try to figure out what's going on. You infer personality traits, like, is this person aggressive? Is that person hostile? Or is that person being funny? All of that kind of happens just in a sense behind your eyes. Like it's just influencing what you see. Mm-hmm. So that's one way in which this stuff is sort of influencing the input to mind reading, right? That's not mind reading there. That's right. This is this research on social psychology showing you how the situation you're in and other things, like your stereotypes, et cetera, influence how you perceive somebody else. And then you go on to attribute beliefs and desires and other sorts of mental states as well. So that's the kind of input side. On the output side, there's...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the traditional mind reading literature, what was focused on was just explanation and prediction. All you really do with your mental state attributions is explain and predict behavior. And I think one of the things that the pluralistic folk psychology view does really well is to say that actually we do lots of things with our mental state attributions. Sometimes we are just moralizing. You see this a lot on social media. You're just sort of broadcasting to people your view on a situation. You're not actually trying to predict. You're not actually trying to explain. You're just, in a sense, trying to judge. Sometimes you're trying to you're confused. You're trying to categorize the behavior. You don't really, necessarily care what they're going to do next. You just, want to have a handy category to put this in. Other times it really matters to you that you get it right. So you are trying to figure out exactly what somebody is thinking and make an accurate prediction because you want to, intervene or because you want to interact or you want to manipulate the situation. There are lots of things that we do on the output side with our mental state attributions. I have this kind of way of dividing things up where things get sort of less messy. Like there's sort of categories that, the input and the processing and the output. But one thing to know is that it just is messy. I mean, this is a real psychological phenomenon or phenomena. And you can bring to bear this kind of conceptual framework for understanding the different categories. But it's not like in any person who's engaged in mind reading, they can easily separate out all these influences. It's, I think pretty opaque to the person who is mind reading what exactly these influences are. So, I hope that the way of dividing these influences is helpful, but that shouldn't lead us to believe that it's really easy to tell what's influencing me when I'm mind reading. Mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, it just happens really fast, and I'm cognitively burdened already, so I'm not really paying attention.
So let me just follow up on something that you mentioned about the context, for example, in the case of, you know, police shooting a black man and the white man gets away unscathed. These exact sorts of cases come up in discussions of the contents of perception. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm trying to think, just the idea that that the actual content of what you see is itself in some way differs, as opposed to the idea that you perceive something and then you interpret it in a certain way in the light of whatever implicit beliefs or those sorts of aspects that are also going on in your psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, do you have any sort of theoretical position on this, whether perception itself is in some way cognitively penetrated or something along those lines, roughly kind of Susanna Siegel's work in perception? Or are you more along the lines of, no, you know, what you perceive is just in some sense not at least penetrated in some way, but clearly we interpret this farther down in the cognitive processing? Do you have any insight on that issue?
Yeah, so I thought about this in a slightly different context. So one dimension of the embodied cognition challenge to mind reading is to claim that we don't have to infer mental states because we can see mental states. We can see other people's beliefs. We can see their emotions. We can see their intentions. We don't have to engage in this theoretical process or the simulational process. Like, all of that is just a bunch of intellectual practice that we don't need to engage in because we can just simply see what somebody's trying to do. And I've tried to kind of figure out what this really means. Like, in a metaphorical sense, it's no problem, but like, right, to kind of break it down, like what in fact does that actually mean? Does that mean that, and just to take the case of intentions, does that mean that intentions are observable? What are the observable aspects of intentions? What in fact does it mean to infer? Like, there just seems to be this difficulty, which is not actually limited to this area of philosophy, but this difficulty in figuring out what an inference actually is. It turns out to be a really tricky issue. So in a series of papers on what I call direct social perception, I try to kind of figure out what the best case scenario is for the idea that we can actually perceive in this thick sense other people's mental states. So I argue that the best way to go, if you want to argue that we can perceive mental states, is to go Susanna Siegel's route, rather than arguing that we don't need inferences because nobody really has an account of inference on hand, and the possible accounts seem to beg the question against mind reading views. A better route is to say that the content of our perception is just richer than the mind reading theorist would argue. And I think that this is actually a little bit plausible for things like emotions. Like, I think emotions are, at least some particular emotions like fear and disgust and anger, are just inextricably tied to behavioral emanations, to facial expressions and things like that, even if they're not, you know, conceptually or necessarily tied to these things. So I think the content of perception route might be a reasonable way to go for things like emotions, or things like like motor intentions or sort of basic intentions, though not like future directed intentions or the things that action theorists care about, like Michael Bratton. So I think that's a way that one could go. But my argument in these papers and my kind of view that I don't express in the book is that that only gets you so far. Uh-huh. If you really need some more machinery on top of that, if you're really going to explain a lot of social cognition. So I think that that gets you a little ways, but not very far.
Okay. So tell us about your model theory. I guess that's you present a, well, it's called the model theory with a capital M, and you present it as basically a version of the theory. Could you tell us a little bit about your overall model?
Sure. So the model theory is taken from this idea that Heidi Maibaum originally articulated in a couple of different papers, 2005, I think, 2003 for one of them. And she sort of did the kind of basic footwork in laying out these different models that one can employ. You can employ folk psychological models or this kind of like social model, like a set of institutional models, different kinds of models for understanding different interactions or different phenomena. And Peter Godfrey Smith kind of picked up this idea in a paper or two and tried to do a little bit more work. But the idea was kind of shelved, like it didn't really get much traction, in part, I think, because of something we mentioned at the very beginning, was that this is about the time that the mind reading literature just kind of stalled out and people got a little bored with dividing the pie and figuring out, does simulation theory get this one or does theory get this one behavioral phenomenon? So it was just sort of left out there for a while. So what I wanted to do in the book and what I'm continuing to do in projects afterwards is take this very kind of general framework of the model theory and see if we can use it to make sense of all the messy stuff that I talk about in the book. So the basic idea is that we, in understanding other people and other social interactions and maybe even understanding things that aren't people like animals, we employ these folk psychological models. And there's just a basic core tenet or tenets to these models that are as common amongst all the different models. And that is the idea that there are ways of representing the world. So there's a kind of, if you want to use direction of fit talk, there's the world representing the mind and the mind representing the world. So something like a belief and something like a desire. There's the basic idea that mental states can sort of interact with each other and influence how you interact with the world. But beyond that, the kinds of models that we employ can vary pretty dramatically. So just to give a few different examples, if I'm on a job search committee and I'm trying to hire a new colleague, somebody who in all likelihood is going to work closely with me, somebody who's going to be on committees with me, somebody who's, you know, in an area that's sort of close to mine, so we might even get to collaborate on projects together. We have a small department, and I want it to be a collegial department, and it matters to me that we hire somebody who's going to be a good fit. So in the interview process, I'm thinking really hard about what this person is like. I'm building, on my view, building kind of folk psychological model of this person. You know, what sort of values do they have? You know, are they going to be somebody who's willing to be on committees? Are they going to do the, you know, the tedious work of service in the department? Are they going to resist that? Are they going to be happy in small town Oklahoma? You know, not everybody is. What kind of, family life are they going to have here? Does that matter to them at all? Things like this, I'm kind of building up a model of that person. And it matters to me that I get it right. So I invest a lot of time thinking about this and comparing it to the other candidates and seeing whether, they're different in ways that are relevant. In this case, I'm building a pretty rich folk psychological model of this person. And I'm using this to make predictions about how they might fit in this place and what they might be like as colleagues. In other cases, the model that I use is way more schematic than that, in part because I don't have the time or desire to build this rich folk psychological model. So when I go to the store and I go through the self-checkout and there's the little person who is, minding the self-checkout line and they, are making small talk with various people who are in the self-checkout line, I don't bother to think very hard about this person's beliefs or desires or intentions or the, how they feel about living in small town Oklahoma. I mean, what I really need is to catch their attention when inevitably the scale stops working. Right. I don't need to think very hard about anything very deep, but I do need to think of them as a person, somebody whose attention needs to be caught. And that I communicate clearly with them. So like the model that I use there is just much more schematic. I mean, these are two very extreme examples. But the idea is, and the project of future work is to kind of figure out the different varieties of models or different families of models, I should say, and see how we employ them. And we employ them in fiction, when we're like watching reality TV, when we're reading novels, when we're interacting with other people on the road. The idea is we kind of build these models to greater and lesser detail in order to understand and interact with other people.
So do we just make these models of persons, or I'm thinking at a more, rather than a token level, at a type level. So for example, when you have time to build up a model like of your, potential colleague, that's one way. But there's, in the case of the officer, right, who comes across the person who they've never presumably encountered before, right? I would assume they're using a model, but there's no time for them to develop a model of that person. In fact, it wouldn't necessarily even make sense for them to develop a model of that person. So can there be models that are just of types or classes?
Well, so stereotypes play a really big role in my view of even very detailed models. So the stereotypes that we have, and so I mean stereotypes in just a neutral way, like they're just beliefs we have about groups of people and members of groups of people. So these could be positive or negative or neutral. The stereotypes we have play a really important role. So I would imagine in situations where it's sort of fast moving, that there's not a lot of reflection on the person, him or herself, that we're interacting with. But we are using a sort of model of this, one that is sort of by and large based on stereotypes. In cases where the interaction is quite fast, you don't have much else to go on. But you do have a script for this interaction, and the script is pretty laden with stereotypes, again, in this sort of technically neutral way. I guess there's no reason to think that you can't have different sorts of models, but I'm just interested in folk psychological models. And I think in that sort of case that you describe, there could be schematic models available to you, so long as you're interacting with this individual as a person and not just a moving object.
Right. Okay. So it sounds somewhat, I mean, I'm sure you know Albert Navin's work, right? Mm-hmm. He seems to be developing something similar.
He does, yes.
Okay. So how does simulation fit into this? Is this just part of the, so that seems to be just a different sort of process than building a model. How does the simulation aspect relate to the model?
Yeah, good. So there are models that have simulational elements. So one of the processes I describe in the book is when you're engaged in a relatively fast interaction or an interaction where it doesn't really matter to you that you get it right. You're using efficiency as a primary motivator rather than accuracy. Here's one sort of simulational process that there could be others, but here's just one that falls into my kind of overall picture. It is when you project your own mental states onto somebody that you regard as relevantly similar to you. So when you think of somebody as, you know, more or less like you in some particular way, they share your values or they're, you know, a working parent or they are, you know, a single white female or something along those lines. And it doesn't matter to you that you get it right. Like it's just a kind of quick interaction. Then you simply just project your own perspective onto that person. And this is a simulational process, right? You sort of figure out what it is that you think about something or what you already know that you figure out about something, and then you just attribute it to this other person. That's a way in which some models could be built, on my view. So my view is a version of the theory, because I view this kind of information-rich process, model construction, that's more in line with the theory view of things than the simulational theory view, because the simulational theory view, if there's one thing that's common amongst all the various versions of simulation theory, it's that it's an information poor process. You don't need to resort to this rich body of folk psychological information to understand other people. You just need to use your own mechanisms to simulate somebody else and then attribute that to other people. Okay. And I think we can do that. That is part of the model building process. And that might be pretty dominant for some sorts of models like the one I described. But the overall view is a theory view, because I think that's just one small way in which we understand other people. And it can be folded into the theory writ large.
Okay. So it makes me think of I think it's called the fundamental attribution bias or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least there's certainly biases in psychology where we tend to think that other people are more like us than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I guess that would fit well into that aspect of the model theory.
That's right. So one of the ways in which we make mistakes, so I kind of in the book go through the prospect for accuracy and these various strategies we use to understand other people. And one of the ways we might make a mistake is in inferring that somebody's too much like us. Another way in which we make mistakes is quite different, is that we infer that somebody's just really different from us. And so we rely on stereotypes instead of just what we could have done, which was to, you know, well, how do you feel about this? And then project that onto somebody else. So there are different ways in which we might make those mistakes.
Right. Well, that brings up, I don't know if you talked about this, or at least not in detail. How do these models get modified? I mean, there seem to be there seem to be problems there might be between what's in a model once it's created and then updating it in the light of new information. So do you have any insight into not just the idea that we create these models, however rich or informationally poor they might be, but then how do we update them?
Yeah, I don't have like a detailed physiological picture of that. So I'm working at a kind of like psychological level. So this might feel a little squishy in some ways. So the basic idea is, like, you know, sometimes we don't update the model in any meaningful ways. Sometimes the power of, for lack of a better word, the anchoring effect is just really hard to resist. Like, you inferred that it was like this, and it's really hard for you to see it in any meaningfully way different. So this is the first way that you understood it, and you kind of don't pay attention to the ways in which the signals that you're getting aren't conforming to the model that you have. In other cases, it's just really obvious that there's a mismatch between what it is that you thought was happening and what it is really happening. And that might be because a prediction is false, or it might be because there's just a glaring inconsistency with your stereotype, for example, or the norms that you have for how this person should interact and what they seem to be doing. So one of the projects I have is to combine the model theory that I have with some work that Evan Westra from Toronto is doing on Bayesian predictive coding. So he also works on mind reading and has got this idea that we can make sense of how people attribute character traits or stereotypes to other people in this hierarchical predictive coding model. And so we are in the very early stages of kind of meshing our viewpoints to make the model theory less squishy.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, that was something that did occur to me, but I'm glad you brought it up. You end the book discussing some of the epistemic and ethical implications of mind reading and your reassessment of mind reading, and in particular the issue of epistemic injustice when certain people are either not paid attention to or not attributed the appropriate level of expertise that they ought to be. Could you say something about these epistemic and ethical implications of your view?
Sure. Yeah, so I was involved in a few different conferences on intellectual humility and understanding that were put on by the Templeton Foundation. And at these conferences, they had a lot of work on epistemic injustice and peer disagreement, the epistemology of peer disagreement. And I'll take the peer disagreement case first, because it just struck me, as somebody who studies mind reading, that it's how we understand others' perspectives and how we, you know, figure out what other people are thinking. It just struck me that the peer disagreement literature was just unreasonably sanitized. So the idea with the peer disagreement literature is this question of what should you do when somebody you take to be an epistemic peer, that is somebody who is comparably rational, comparably informed, comparably well motivated, and they have the same sorts of good intentions that you do, when they disagree with you about something. And the idea seemed to be that you could take these two different tacks. If somebody who has equal knowledge or comparable knowledge, there's some sort of debate about how we distinguish these things, and yet they disagree with you, you should stick to your guns, because if you guys are equally competent and equally knowledgeable and equally rational, then there's no reason why you should discount your own judgment there. And the other tact seemed to be that if you have this case where you have a peer who's an epistemic peer who's disagreeing with you, you should conciliate. You should have less confidence in your own view, because somebody who has just as much knowledge and just as much rationality as you do has disagreed with you. So that should lead you to kind of take pause. And I'm coming at this, you know, from the perspective of thinking, like, not only is it that we never have equal knowledge, it's the judgment of who's an epistemic peer is never so clean cut. It's, we are never perfectly accurate about judging who has equal or even comparable knowledge, or who has equal or even comparable rational ability or intentions. So that debate about peer disagreement seems to be picked up from the starting point of, okay, somebody's an epistemic peer. What do you do when they disagree? And my worry is that the stuff that comes before that, how you judge somebody who's an epistemic peer, it is really well documented in the social psychology literature, even setting aside some of the experiments that or paradigms that have replicability issues. It's really well documented that some demographics get sort of automatically down, or I should say not automatically, but in many situations get downgraded epistemically and some get upgraded. So for example, there's this tendency to regard elderly individuals as incompetent. So there's these kind of trade-offs between competence and likability. So sometimes you'll find somebody like an elderly woman who's regarded as incompetent because she's elderly, but she's regarded as warm because she's a woman, because this is another association that we have. So you regard typically the emotion that's associated with this is pity. Like you like the lady, but she's incompetent. So
this is Susan Fiske's work.
That's right. So the idea that we can just kind of come to judge that somebody's an epistemic peer ignores all these influences, that somebody might actually be an epistemic superior to us. And just in virtue of these associations and the inferences that go along with them, we will infer that they are an epistemic peer, or perhaps even an epistemic subordinate rather than an epistemic superior. So with respect to the epistemology of peer disagreement literature, I just think there's a lot that needs to go into how we judge whether somebody is subordinate, a peer, or superior. And that would really change what we should do after that point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, should we infer that should we conciliate or should we remain steadfast? It really depends on the process leading up to the judgment that somebody is epistemically inferior or a peer or superior.
Okay. So yeah, this also comes up in, I think, in the epistemology of testimony as well.
That's right.
So what, I mean, I think we have time for one final substantive question. So a lot of the book, what the book is doing overall is kind of updating the philosophical framework in which we think about mind reading and social cognition more generally. And that's being done by incorporating various insights from, you know, developmental, but mainly, I think, social psychology. What does this new, improved, let's assume, philosophical framework provide to the psychologists or economists or, you know, any of the other groups, right? It's so at this point, it looks like we're playing catch up. And the question is, well, what are we doing that can actually go the other way?
Yeah, so one point about the psychologist, maybe not the social psychologist. Well, I mean, psychologists in general, so developmental, cognitive, and social, is that there's just not been a lot of overlap with social psychology and these other disciplines and philosophy in general. So this is... So social psychologists reading this are going to probably read a lot of philosophy that they're just not familiar with, even though they've been working on things in social cognition. They don't typically understand this in terms of mind reading. They don't have that sort of conceptual framework for understanding things. So the divorce between social psychology and philosophy and developmental psychology and cognitive psychology more generally is been sort of deep from the beginning of this mind reading literature. So part of what the social psychologist ought to get out of this is just that there's this field that's been running, not quite in parallel, but, you know, in the neighborhood, that is actually really relevant to the stuff that they are working on. But just kind of zooming out a little bit, what I think that, I mean, so this is a question really about interdisciplinary research in general. And what I think philosophers are really good at is, of course, this sort of conceptual analysis and sort of thinking through concepts and seeing whether they're consistent, but also doing this kind of synthesis work of looking at different fields and figuring out what are the ideas and how are they matching up with the ideas in this other field, and how do we make sense, how do we put all of this together, like which are the parts that cohere well together, which are the parts that don't cohere well together. And this, of course, is not research that philosophers are uniquely able to do. Similarly, it's not that psychologists are uniquely able to run experiments. Philosophers can run experiments as well. It's just that we're each trained to be particularly good at this part. So philosophers are trained to be really good at this sort of synthesis work, at this kind of looking at different conceptual frameworks and different schema to figure out how to make sense of all of this together. Psychologists could do this. They haven't. Philosophers could do this. I think that they've done quite a bit more of that, and I'm hoping they do more to incorporate the social psychology. So I think the thing that we get out of this, we in a kind of general sense, is just this bigger picture of understanding other people that just has not been put together in any meaningful way.
Okay. So we have time for one last question, which is, what is next for you? Are you working on a follow-up, or what sort of projects are in your immediate horizon?
So there are a few. So one is a project on model theory, which I describe in the book. And this is the project with Evan Westra. So we are co-editing, along with Kristen Andrews, a special issue in Synthes on pluralistic bulk psychology. And we are contributing papers, or hopefully contributing papers, on that topic as well to Synthes. So that's one project that I'm working on that's pretty relevant to the stuff in the book. Hopefully that will give a little bit more meat to model theory. Another project that comes up in the book a little bit is my work with Guillermo de Fanal on implicit bias. We have this model of implicit bias that we lay out in a recent paper in Mind and Language that's based on this well-established framework for concept learning. And we are doing a follow-up paper to that on the issue of whether implicit biases are beliefs. Finally, a third project that's not quite as tightly tied to the project in the book is a project on the development of empathy. So I, along with Rita Svetlova and Rosalie and Thomas Nagelhofer and Hannah Reed, all from Duke, are engaged in this project that is an fMRI study of kiddos and the processes, the neural mechanisms for empathy and how they develop over time. And the hope is, once we get that study off the ground, funded for now, we're hoping to get some more funding from the NIH to extend this to how we have empathy towards in-group and out-group members in a developmental mm-hmm. framework. So when it is that we start to be less empathetic towards out-group members and what particular out-group members, this, what whether it's gender or class or like when these sorts of outgroupings start to make a difference to kind of get this better picture of how these social biases develop over time.
Cool. What age group are you looking at?
So we are looking at 5 to 11 or 5 to 8 right now. And then we'll get older. So we had this, the reason I'm hesitating is like, we had this concern about braces, in the fMRI scanner. So we wanted to avoid the age at which kid get braces because then they couldn't go in the scanner.
Right. Yeah. Right. Huh. Yeah. Yeah, I guess like at age 11 or 12, that starts to be a problem.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, one of these things that philosophers just don't often think about.
Yeah. Well, you know, you'd be surprised. So that sounds really, very cool. Yeah. But we are out of time for now, but, I appreciate your talking about your book with us, and I wish you luck with these exciting new projects.
Thank you. It's really fun to talk to you.
Great. Well, thanks again and good luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Shannon Spaulding, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Oklahoma State University. We've been talking about her new book, How We Understand Others, Philosophy and Social Cognition, which is just out from Routledge. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoy the podcast and thank you for listening.